Welcome to Green and Red, Scrappy Politics for Scrappy People, a regular podcast on radical, environmental and anti-capitalist politics, brought to you by Bob Bazanko and Scott Parkin.
Welcome to the Silky Smooth Sounds of the Green and Red podcast. I'm your co-host, Scott Parkin, in Berkeley, California. And as always, I'm joined by...
From Niles, Ohio, Bob Bazanko.
Today is the 25th anniversary of September 11th, a date which changed a lot of things. It's when Al-Qaeda attacked the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, and it changed a number of things. And so today we're going to be talking about the impact of 9/11 on our country and the world, really. And so as a sort of commemoration episode, we haven't done a commemoration episode on 9/11 in quite some time.
As I used to say, because I would teach about this, the events of 9/11 are indefensible, but you have to understand them. You ignore that and just simply say they hated us because we're so free, or they hate us because we're better than them. You take that approach at your own peril, because it means you don't learn anything, which is pretty much what's happened, right? So I think it's important to understand what 9/11 meant. As I look back on kind of modern history, let's say from the mid-19th century forward, the only thing I think comparable to the legacy of 9/11 would be World War II, which was obviously immense. The way the world's changed after September 2001 is really remarkable. And we're going to deal with it in maybe three or four different areas. First, I want to talk about what it meant in the Middle East, which we see every day. That's obviously in our face every day. We know that what we're seeing right now with regard to Trump, not just in Iran, but Israel's role in Gaza and Lebanon and these attacks all over the region, has a direct line to the events of September 2001. We're going to talk about what it meant here at home in terms of kind of the economy, with a specific focus on the military industrial complex, the amount of money now that's spent on the military and on militarism. We're going to talk about what it meant domestically, internally, how it affected American politics, with a real focus on the more than rise of, certainly, the eruption of a surveillance state that is far beyond what we probably would have imagined, unless we were like reading science fiction or something like that. And then we want to talk, the kind of thing that I think we think is hopeful coming out of this is that it has, I think, created a new consensus, really, on the ideas of war and foreign interventions and so forth, right? Which we're also seeing today. There's this real revulsion about a lot of this. But in general, it's not a good picture, right? What we've seen since then. So we'll try to be brief, because obviously you could spend weeks talking about the impact of 9/11. I think the most direct way to start this, obviously, is the regional context of the United States and the Middle East. And the U.S. role in the Middle East wasn't exactly stable, but the United States clearly had a more or less hegemonic role in there, especially because it had Israel doing its work for it in the region. However, you started to see the emergence of the terrorists and the terror era, really in the 80s and 90s especially, and the World Trade Center was bombed in 1993. And then you had the emergence of Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, with attacks all over, mostly in the Middle East region, Saudi and obviously in Afghanistan and Lebanon and elsewhere. But it really hits home in the United States then for the first time in 2001. There had been domestic terrorism, to be sure, right? McVeigh and right-wing militias. But outside of the World Trade Center, you didn't really see this, what they would call, often the media would refer to it as Islamic terrorism in the United States. But on 9/11, just a horrific day with airplanes hitting the two towers in New York, the Pentagon, one plane being brought down in Pennsylvania, right? And what that did inevitably was lead to a war, which became many wars, which morphed into many wars in the Middle East. Initially, it's Afghanistan. Bin Laden had at one point was using Afghanistan as a sanctuary. So that became the reason for that. In addition to that, Afghanistan had a government that the U.S. had tried to prevent from coming to power, the Taliban and so forth. So it's kind of convenient. And also, as Donald Rumsfeld so eloquently put it, there aren't any good targets in Afghanistan, but there's a lot of good targets in Iraq. Even though Iraq had nothing really to do with 9/11, there was kind of leftover business from the first Gulf War in 1991. And so the United States attacked Iraq in March of 2003. And it's something like, I think every time I talk about this, it's important to understand too. Bush and Cheney did this despite a huge number of warnings, not from peaceniks, but from like George Bush Sr., George Herbert Walker Bush, right? and Scowcroft and Baker and all kinds of generals and diplomats. So the prevailing consensus among the foreign policy establishment at that point was that invading Iraq in 2003 is a bad idea and it's going to lead to no good, right? For their own particular reasons, Cheney especially, because I think he was more influential in making decisions than Bush was, as were Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and the rest, ignored all this and they invaded, right? Saddam was gone with what, about a month, barely a month, I think Saddam was already ousted. But, and they thought that, that would end the war, much Trump recently thought that bombing Iran would end the war in 48 hours, right? Obviously, it doesn't. That's not the way these things work. The fighting continued in Iraq. A lot of militias emerged. They began fighting using kind of guerrilla, urban guerrilla tactics, things like IEDs. And the war continued for several years after that, right? And you saw the emergence of these kind of armies. A lot of them were led by Ba'ath officials, Ba'athist officials who had been associated with Saddam, or they were old Iraqi army units, right? And they waged like urban warfare, the most famous probably a place like Fallujah. And by 2007, 2008, over 4,000 Americans had died in Iraq. At the time, compared to Vietnam, that may not seem like a lot, but after Vietnam, there was this kind of implicit agreement. We're not going to fight and get Americans killed anymore, right? That's what we're going to try to use other countries to do our dirty work for us or have these quick things like Panama or Grenada or whatever, right? But we're not going to have large numbers of Americans killed. That becomes a problem now because several thousand soldiers are killed in Iraq. And in 2007, rather than the war being over, as politicians have promised, it actually was increased with the surge. And much of the surge, which the US painted as a military success, was due to the fact that the United States paid off a bunch of and armed a bunch of Sunni and other groups in Iraq. And the impact of that was significant, right? Inside the United States, I think it discredited the old Cold War elite. Hillary Clinton ran for president that year in the Democratic Party nomination and was defeated stunningly by a virtually unknown black senator named Barack Obama, who promised to end the war, who had voted against the war in Iraq, right?
Of a factor that year, but Joe Biden also Cold Warrior, longtime
Yeah.
Cold Warrior,
The
lost
old,
that
I think the old
primary.
Cold War guard, McCain, was considered obviously a hawk. He was defeated, and the economy blew up as well. So that certainly had a lot to do with it. But I think Iraq already by 2008 was discrediting the old Cold War kind of ideology, Cold War leadership. Not to say it won't come back, especially with in regard to people like Biden, right? The war brought Iran and Iraq closer together, which is really unimaginable, right? It increased terror attacks, especially in places like Afghanistan and Pakistan, where American targets, American bases, American diplomatic missions were attacked with even more frequency. The United States' image in the region, which certainly wasn't good to begin with, was tarnished even more, not just because of Iraq, but also because of its increased support of Israel, which we'll briefly talk about here, right? So it really exacerbated anti-Americanism in the region. It led then to increased warfare because of these terror attacks. Obama, who won the election, took over in 2009, actually intensified a lot of the attacks there, especially with drones. What was it, 26,000 drone attacks, I believe, that Obama conducted. The insurgency by 2013 and 2014 had morphed into ISIS, the Islamic State, right? So the United States actually managed to bring out even more radical elements. Saddam Hussein was not a didn't respect human rights any more than Bibi Net, well, actually probably did more than Bibi Netanyahu did, but actually I'm sure he did, but he brought stability to that area and in fact to the region, much like Gaddafi did, who was overthrown in 2011. And so with that gone, you have the emergence of what would be called radical Islam, right? Ironically, one of the leaders of ISIS is now the president of Syria. There had been, what, a $10 million bounty on his head. Now he's being visiting the White House and getting cheeseburgers and Diet Cokes and things like that,
He
right?
complimented on his looks.
Yeah. Now that takes us through the Obama years. Now, this is where I think it gets really interesting because, in a sense, that follows a script. What's interesting is because what we talked about, how inside the United States, that old consensus has been broken down. And one of the people who I think really contributed to breaking down that old consensus was Donald Trump in 2016. Because one of the key elements of Trump's campaign that year was no more wars, no more forever wars, or fighting stupid wars. He criticized the Vietnam War, he criticized Obama, criticized Bush, right? And
McCain
so
and
you have
McCain.
Ed McCain and all these people, right? And he's to the point where a lot of us were like, shit, the guy made, you had to concede he made sense. You actually, shit, I agree with him. There's somebody, he's, I don't know if he's smart enough or somebody told him to, but he was smart enough to understand that the American people are sick of these wars, whether you mean it or not. And clearly he didn't. Let me speak out against them. And that was really important because Hillary Clinton was clearly associated with that. Clinton voted for the Iraqi wars. Her husband was part of that generation. She had repeatedly promised that she would blow up Iran, much like pretty much every leading Democrat did, right? Biden did, Kamala Harris did. Trump really created some space there, right? And so there was this sense that things were going to be different. Now, obviously, they weren't, right? The U.S. role in that region continued. Trump continued. He broke the agreement with Iran, the JCPOA on nuclear development with Iran. He engaged in assassinations of leaders, continued to support Israel. And this is really important. And this is often left out. And it doesn't, what we're doing now doesn't do it justice. But in the years after 9/11, the American-Israeli relationship grew even closer, right? And clearly by that time, the United States was supporting Israel's worst instincts all over. But with regard to what's happening today, in 2006, at George Bush's behest, really, elections were held in Gaza. And they flipped the script, and Hamas won those elections. So Hamas came to power because Bush and Cameron had insisted on elections, right? What that did was actually increase Israeli terrorism in that region, in that area, right? So in 2008, Israel began attacks on Gaza and killed over 1,400 Palestinians, well before October 2023. In 2014, in a series of attacks, Israel killed over 2,100 Palestinians. In 2018, Israel fired on peaceful protests and killed 170 Palestinians. In 2021, Israel attacked the Al-Aqsa Mosque and killed 260 Palestinians. August of 2022, this is by no means obviously an exhaustive list and just some of the lowlights of it, right? August 2022, Israeli air attacks killed 30 peaceful protesters. All of these occurred with increased American aid, increased American support, increased American cover at places like the United Nations and international courts. So what, and we haven't, we'll get it up and we'll finish this part in a second. So up to 2022, 2023, the impact of 9/11 was actually more destabilization in the region, more war crimes and atrocities committed by Israel with American support, increased tension, especially with regard to Iran, the war between Saudi, the destruction of Yemen by Saudi Arabia is part of that. The United States participates in that and spends, I forget how much, I have it written down later, a significant amount of money. So there's a massive destabilization in the region, and it becomes, which really is going to affect American interests, right? Now, in 2023, somehow, hard to believe, things get much worse. That's when Israel begins its openly public, unapologetic genocide with full-scale American support under Joe Biden. And this is bipartisan. This stuff is bipartisan. And then obviously, after Trump wins again, these attacks on Iran, the basic story now is that this is done on behalf of Israel. That Netanyahu had been trying to get Americans to attack Iran for years, which is true, and that Trump took the bait. I think there are American interests in this too. As I said before, Hillary Clinton said she'd attack Iran. Joe Biden said he'd attack Iran. Kamala Harris said he'd attack Iran. So there's kind of a consensus here. So there's clearly Trump is not exactly a genius, and it's probably easier to dupe him than others. But this had also been, there had been sanctions on Iran for decades, right? So what 9/11 did, in a nutshell, this is very brief, really was destabilize that region to the point where today the United States is really on the run. American bases are being targeted and hit by Iran every day in Kuwait, in Bahrain, in UAE, in Saudi, in the entire region, in Jordan, right? Every country now is at risk. Israel is a global pariah, right? It's conducting a genocide in Gaza, obviously, and probably in southern Lebanon, right? It has a huge impact, and we'll get to this, on the American economy, on the global economy, right? Which 9/11 initially was really terrifying from that perspective, because it basically, the initial thought was like, well, air traffic is going to be destroyed, right? People will be afraid to get in airplanes anymore. There'll be a decline in global trade. That bounce back occurred pretty quickly. There was massive amount of government money infused into the economy, trillions of dollars, which also creates the groundswell for doing this again and again. So in 2008, you see a massive amount of federal money injected into the economy when the banks crash, 2020 with COVID, and then it just becomes part of the global scene, right? In the period since 2008, and I don't know what it is before that, but it would certainly be bigger. But since 2008, central banks have simply invented something like $20 trillion to put into the global economy, right? Which means that we all know we're now running these massive deficits as well. So, from a geopolitical point of view, the impact of 9/11 2001 was cataclysmic, right? It's led to destabilization, declined standard of living, to a genocide, and to a war, which right now, as we speak, has put a huge hammer lock on the global economy. It's diminished, obviously, American prestige in the world, which isn't necessarily a bad thing, but it has a huge impact at home, too. All of these things have a huge impact at home with regard to the way I live our lives, the way we spend our money, and those kind of things. So that's the regional part of it, right? But I also want to talk, we also want to talk about what it means in terms of the American economy and militarism, right? Scott, do you want to talk a little bit about what it did with regard to militarism and military spending?
Yeah, the first thing I want to say is that the US had already been in this period where we were embracing privatization. It starts in the 19, let's say it starts in the 1970s. In the 90s, the Clinton administration is very much all about austerity and privatization of different parts of the government, including the Pentagon. When 9/11 happens, there was a study that came out in 2021. I actually haven't found anything more recent, but between 9/11, this study was put out on the 10th anniversary, excuse me, the 20th anniversary of 9/11, and up to half of the $14 trillion spent by the Pentagon since 9/11 went to private for-profit defense contractors. And we've done a bunch of shows on this in the past, but Raytheon, Lockheed, General Dynamics, Northrop, Boeing are like the top echelon of weapons manufacturers that are getting money to with a nice cut off of the top to get to basically provide weapons, provide intelligence, provide surveillance systems, what have you, to the US military and other allied militaries as well. With the sort of privatized defense sector, I think it's also worth noting that the sort of case study, the poster child of this privatization since 9/11 was a little company called Halliburton. And they provided the oil infrastructure support. They owned another company called KBR, formerly Kellogg Brown and Root, which provided logistical support to troops on the ground, things like food and transportation around Iraq and all of that. Bob and I got our start as organizers organizing against Halliburton in the Iraq War period. The former CEO of Halliburton was Dick Cheney, which in many ways is the architect of a lot of this post-9/11 period. And it's we're this privatization is pretty normal. Trump now wants to privatize like Yosemite, right? And so it's a pretty normal sort of playbook, but it's important for the advancement of the military industrial complex that 9/11 is really a moment where we see this another big shift towards this. We talk a lot about the rise of the military industrial complex at the beginning of the Cold War. Eisenhower famously warned against it in his like exit speech from the presidency. But 9/11 is a period where we really see the rise of this like private sector, private profit around military and weapons manufacturing and so on and so forth.
As we often said, this is one area where you can be socialist, right? You can spend massive amounts of public money on the military, and we saw that in 2001 when the attacks occurred. The and these numbers are all kind of variable. They're not official. Official spending numbers are always low because the military or the Pentagon will come back for supplementals, and they're associated. So these are variants of that. But in 2001, the military budget was about $330 billion. At the time, that was roughly equal to the rest of the world because China wasn't spending that much money yet at that point, right? So in 2001, the next year, it went up to $378 billion. In 2003, which is when the second Gulf War begins, it's up to $490 billion. So you're looking at nearly a half trillion dollars and about a 50% increase in just 2 years. By 2006 and 7, when the surge occurs, you're looking at $550 to $600 billion. This is when Obama takes over. In the Obama years, it roughly stays in that area between $600 and $700 billion a year, which again is about the same as the rest of the world combined. Now, this is where it gets interesting, right? Because Trump took over saying, no more wars, no more forever wars. We can't be spending money on this. And obviously, what is an increase in Pentagon budgets and an increase in militarization, right? And so, in the first Trump term, the defense budgets were in the $750 billion or so range. They went up in the Biden years, especially after aid to Ukraine began, and then especially, obviously, after a significant aid to Israel began. So by 2003, you started to see $900 billion budgets. Trump is now talking about $1.5 trillion budgets, right? China now spends more money, so the ratio isn't quite the same. It's not like 1 to 1, the US versus the rest of the world. But the US does spend more money in its military budget than the next 10 countries. The United States has over 800 bases. The rest of the world doesn't. The United States has, I always forget this number, I think 22 carriers. The rest of the world combined has far fewer than that. What's also interesting on this is that most of this stuff, especially the combat costs, because the wars themselves, the actual fighting in Afghanistan and Iraq, and these are not huge countries and huge wars. This isn't like a world war, like World War II fought in Asia, Europe, and all over, right? These are fairly centralized, right? The actual combat cost of Iraq and Afghanistan were somewhere in the $5 to $6 trillion area. And the best source for this, if you're interested, is the Brown University Cost of War Project. But what's important, and again, the media doesn't talk about this because we hear a lot today about deficits. The American deficit is now over $40 trillion, right? Most of those wars were funded by debt. You know, in the past, you fund
No.
wars, you could raise taxes, you could sell war bonds. These weren't. These were funded by borrowing. They were funded by debt, right? So interest alone, just on those wars, is over $1 trillion. Veterans spending on veterans has already crossed over $500 billion, and that's going to increase by trillions because so many vets were badly disabled, permanently disabled after those wars. World War I and II, even Vietnam, medicine, battlefield medicine wasn't as advanced. So a lot of people died by these wars. You're starting to see vets who will be in VA care for the rest of their lives. So those numbers are going to increase by the trillions, right? So the cost of Afghanistan and Iraq aren't settled yet. They're ongoing and they're still increasing, right? And then that doesn't even include Israel, what we've seen since 2023. Every so often, the United States will send $20 billion, and then you have $3 billion here, and then $2 billion here, and just an immense amount of money. At the same time, the United States has spent $10 to $12 billion to fight against Yemen. And then, in not even bare, well, barely now, 6 months, the official estimates are $113 billion for Iran. There are estimates which go even higher than that, which basically say it's been about $1 billion a day. Right. Just the other day, Iran attacked American bases and caused nearly $1 billion of damage in one 24-hour barrage of attacks. Right. That leads to debt. And debt, Dick Cheney said deficits don't matter. Maybe he's right. But each American currently owns $140,000 of national debt. You're born with it now. And this becomes the excuse, right? We have all these debts. So we can't spend money on education. We can't spend money on healthcare. We can't build parks. We can't clean the climate. We can't clean the environment. We can't do any of this because we've got debt.
When they change the name of the Strait of Hormuz to the Strait of Trump, that's going to be one expensive name change. That's all I got to say. It's one big vanity project going on right there.
Yeah. So there are various factors for our economic situation right now, right? And obviously, tax cuts are a big part of it. You had Bush tax cuts, which were continued by Obama. And then you've had 2 rounds now of massive Trump tax cuts, which obviously lead to a deficit. You had the massive influx of federal money, Fed money, 2008, and then obviously COVID money. So you've basically just invented a lot of money. But I would argue the biggest part of it is actually all these wars. And that's usually left out of the equation because this is obviously bipartisan, right? In the United States, nobody speaks against wars, nobody speaks against defense budgets. You're lucky if you can get a half dozen votes against defense budgets. Usually, other than the socialist and maybe Thomas Massie, everybody votes for these things anyway.
The lobbying firms cater to both parties and are
Yeah.
staffed with former staffing members of
Yeah. I
Congress
mean,
from both
yeah,
parties.
exactly. In the Cold War era, when you think of the people who are most connected to the military, to me, it'd be like Biden, Joe Lieberman, Lindsey Graham, right? But it's clearly bipartisan. Lieberman is as much as anybody, right? So, and nobody questions that, and the media doesn't really talk about it. But when you talk about like how do you fix the American economy, one good way to start would be just these defense budgets, which are just overblown, right? 800 and some bases, more than the net 10 next companies. And the United States has no enemies. It has enemies, but not in in an area where they could actually do America damage. Canada, I'm sure would want to, but Canada's not about to attack the US. Mexico's not about to attack the US. The Atlantic and Pacific are pretty big oceans. Europe may be fed up with the United States, but it's not about to attack it. So America's defense budget has been bloated and overblown for since 1945. But now it really makes no sense. But that's not even part of the discussion. You're not allowed to discuss that. But those numbers are massive, and you're looking at a trillion. Now that's $1 trillion officially defense budget. We've had years, a couple of years ago, we had on William Hartung. There's the real cost, which incorporates some various things like the global war on terror and so forth. And so that $1 trillion is obviously already more than that. And it's just continuing to grow, right? So the military industrial complex, as you pointed out, the stocks, the stock prices of all those companies have grown. The profits of all those companies have gone up. You now have insider deals with Trump's son, who are investing in companies which are getting contracts to build drones or whatever. There's now, and one part of this, which is really unbelievable, and again, the media's not paying enough attention, is like the United States is running out of weapons, which is really stunning, right? You're spending hundreds of billions of dollars every year, 750 billion, 900 billion, 1 trillion, and you don't have enough stuff. That's because that money is going to Grauman and all of those companies, Lockheed and Boeing and so
I didn't
forth.
go through and pull, and what I've done for some of these is go through and pull the how the stock of these weapons manufacturers have fared, say, in the last 8 months or 6 months since the war started. I didn't do that. But one fact I did find was that I think it was Raytheon, when they reopened the stock market on September 17th, 2001, their stock went up to $43. Raytheon's stock today is $349. And so, since the Iran war started, that's how much value that we've seen increase within these weapons manufacturing companies in the last 25 years.
In that period too, I think they carry the increase in the kind of like artificial intelligence does now, like much of AI is driving the stock market. Companies like that did back then. Yeah, the government was just handing out these massive contracts. As you point out with the Halliburton. Halliburton got contracts to rebuild the Middle East before the war began. And the vice president is their ex-CEO, right? In the civilian world, that would be insider training. The SEC may have even at the time even probably would have come down on you. Now, and Trump, if Cheney were alive, he'd be so jealous of Trump, what he's gotten away with. And Cheney was as evil as Trump, a little bit smarter, but not as audacious, maybe not as crazy, but really quite remarkable.
Even Cheney had more respect for the norms, I guess you could say, than Trump does.
But
To say the
I
least.
think, I think those guys thought that doing these kinds of things would bring so much attention and so much resistance that it wouldn't be worth it. And they kind of got what they got what they wanted. That's the thing about Trump too. You can get what you want without this. That's why I don't make any sense. I've never seen the kind of whole oil thing. You had access to all this oil anytime you wanted it. You've gotten this without whatever they're doing. Anyways, that's huge, right? So you have this massive impact in the Middle East, which has been badly destabilized and is now the source of hot war all over, which threatens the stability of the entire globe. You have this massive shift in the United States economy, right? And then one of the things that you and I talk about a lot, which is really, I think, quite terrifying, is this massive growth of the surveillance state. Something that, like, and we now have technologies that have made those old science fiction stories come to life, right? So the amount of money spent on it and the impact of it on whatever democracy was left has been catastrophic.
And just looking at some of the numbers we put together for this is the Department of Homeland Security, which was created in the wake of 9/11,
The
between
Patriot Act.
the
The
Patriot
Patriot.
Act, but Homeland.
Isn't that scary? The Patriot Act and Homeland Security, like
It's as
evoking
Orwellian
these.
as you can,
They're really, and Nazi. They really do evoke Nazi ideas.
Homeland
It didn't
Security and
start
the
with Trump.
Patriot Act.
No, that didn't start with Trump. That's Bush and Cheney. Yeah.
You can also trace some of the Patriot Act back to Clinton too, post Oklahoma City bombing. But Homeland Security between 2001 and 2022 spent over $1 trillion. The current budget of ICE, which also was created after 9/11 to police for criminal immigrants, the current budget is $118 billion. It was about 6 billion annually prior to Trump, and it's obvious it's the fastest growing budget item. And then on the surveillance front, specifically on companies that that sell the government or run these systems for domestic surveillance technology, this is the Palantirs of the world. The government since 2021, January 2021, has recorded more than $2.9 billion in specific contracts to these companies, like the Palantir company and companies like that. And so it's just really worth noting how much, one, we're investing in the government policing its own population, like domestic population of the US, and then how much of that's being outsourced.
And you see it in everyday life. Before September 11, 2001, go to the airport, you could walk all the way to the gate, even if you weren't on a flight with your friends, or pick them up at the gate. And then you have the creation of TSA, which becomes more intrusive. And then you start to see, and this is in the first Bush, not the first Bush, the second Bush's first term, you start to see people getting in trouble for library books they've checked out. Start to see the government getting more involved. You drive on the highways, and every mile there's a sign. If you see anything uncomfortable, call 1-800-SNITCH
If you
on and
see
that.
something, say something.
Yeah, that kind of stuff.
It's
And
all
they
over New
create
York
this,
City's
yeah,
subways.
this snitch culture, right? And but and obviously a particular target of it even then is or Muslims, right? And this is when you see this immense and now really violent Islamophobia come about. And that was incited. That wasn't just accidental, right? Despite Bush occasionally saying, no, don't, it's not everybody. Clearly, the government fomented that. And now there's all the gloves are off. And you have, especially in Texas, you have Texas's officials, government officials, essentially encouraging people to remove Muslims in Texas. Remove, get, we want all of you gone in Texas, what that can mean. So,
A number of the politicians are running on removing Islam from the state of Texas.
yeah. No, even I'm here in Ohio, and they're talking in ads for the Republicans here in Ohio. They're bringing in Mamdani and El Sayed and all that kind of stuff. And that's a real product of this too. And you need that right after World War II was communist and after World War I it was anarchist or Japanese in World War II. You always need some kind of enemy, and Muslims have clearly filled the bill. And I think Hollywood did that too, didn't it? Didn't you start to see that?
I mean, I think you really started seeing it in the 90s, after the 80s and 90s, with like where we're in these terror wars against Gaddafi or the PLO or whatever, but definitely really escalates after 2001, is when you see the Muslim terrorists, the Islamic terrorists, are the chief villains in a lot of these films, right? And so it becomes very ingrained. I mean, whatever, Hollywood is going to sell whatever product on television or film they can. And on the, I think it's also very notable. It's like on the television shows like 24 and Homeland, which is like a copy of an Israeli show, that where Muslims are these shadowy Muslim groups that are very much like Osama bin Laden and Al Qaeda are like are the villains. And any means necessary is okay, even if it violates the Constitution or domestic laws or whatever, to protect the homeland. So.
We don't want your red tape, which is making keeping our hands tied. We want to be able to fight. And you said, and the technology obviously goes to levels that were unimaginable before. And Trump now has gone into areas that McCarthyism never did.
It should be really noted, we talked about the Patriot Act for a second there, but the Patriot Act was the first real bill criminalizing, it criminalized Muslims. There's a lot of Muslims that got rounded up post 9/11 under the auspices of the Patriot Act. The metadata collection is, we also, that's what we also see in the Bush administration too, right? And there were like civil libertarians who were like in the Department of Justice who resisted this. I think Trump has gutted any people like that at this point. But the metadata collection, where they're like working with the telecommunications companies to gain all the data that they can get. The government has actually gathered so much metadata from all over the world and all over the country. It's like it's unimaginable the amount of information that they have on us. And then we also see the use of facial recognition and other location tracking through our smartphones or through other things like that. And so that's when all of this starts too. And all of that is a result of 9/11 as well. In 2013, there was a whistleblower named Edward Snowden who leaked a lot of government files, which exposed this. And that's also when we see the government wage war on whistleblowers. The Obama administration really goes after whistleblowers, both people who had put out information, who had worked for government agencies or the military, people like Chelsea Manning and Snowden, who basically just lives in exile in Russia now, but also people within the press, including James Risen, who we've had on the show, was actually targeted for working with by the Obama administration in working with whistleblowers. And so it's really kind of really the dark period. That stuff is not talked about enough. And then the other thing I want to talk about with the surveillance state is that even though Al Qaeda had attacked the U.S. and the U.S. launches these wars, is the FBI, the sort of domestic law, preeminent law, domestic law enforcement agency, basically also does a shift in focus to really go after who they saw as domestic enemies, which are radical environmentalists and radical animal rights activists. And that's where we have the Green Scare. And we've done a lot of shows on this, even just recently. So I don't have to go into it too much, but they use the Patriot Act against these groups, right? They really went hard and put people from Stop Huntington Animal Cruelty in prison. They went after the Earth Liberation Front, charged both people within SHAC, people within the Earth Liberation Front, people within the Animal Liberation Front with all these terrorist predicates, so that their enhancements were worse, their records were worse. They still use that just recently in the case in Prairie Land, where they were charged as terrorists. And so that led to them being convicted of a bunch of charges and them stacking the charges. And so you see people getting 30 years for moving a box of zines, people getting 50 years for going to a protest. And for the guy who exchanged shots with the police, he got 100 years. And certain, if you weren't doing that politically, you'd probably get a lot less time for all of those things. And so we see the government really seize upon this opportunity of 9/11 to really go after people they see as their domestic enemies. And so that's a big theme here too, is that Cheney saw an opportunity after 9/11 to go into Iraq. The industry and the FBI saw an opportunity after 9/11 to go after their domestic opponents. And so, very important thing to note here. Trump, actually, I would say about a year ago, Trump tried to repeat that with Charlie Kirk. It's like Charlie Kirk gets shot. It's unclear the political affiliation of the person who shot him, but they use that as an opportunity to go after Antifa. And that's actually how Prairie Land happened too. So it's really worth noting that that people in power try to seize these opportunities to take advantage and what I think turns into overreach.
And not
There's
that
a
anybody
lot
really
in
cares about,
that.
yeah, no, but and not that really people care about this anymore. But that impacted international law as well. You had right after, while the war was being fought, not long after the war began in 2003, you had the exposés of Abu Ghraib and Gitmo with these really ugly forms of torture there, and really no one was held accountable, right? That when Obama came in, he basically said no, and Merrick Garland kind of shit, right? We're going to keep the peace, we're going to move forward, and all that kind of stuff. And so now, when you see Israel committing a genocide and violating the International Court of Justice, violating the UN, nobody cares. And it's kind of hard to say, yeah, this is what happened to Bush. This is what happened to Obama. Obama's drone attacks. Obama was double tapping drones, drone attacks, right? So 9/11 eviscerated whatever, and there wasn't much, but eviscerated what little was left of international law as well, right? And then, as you pointed out, now we're at the point where we're in a situation, as Ellen Schrecker said, is way worse than McCarthyism. Trump's new directives say that you're essentially a terrorist if you're Antifa, which means anti-fascist, right? If you advocate civil rights too strongly, if you're anti-Christian, whatever that means, if you're anti-capitalist, if you're anti-American, essentially, if Trump decides he doesn't like you, you're a terrorist, right?
It's a Green and Red
And
podcast.
yeah, it could be anything, right? Look at some of the people they've gone after, right? And Miss Rachel was voted anti-Semite of the year or something like that, right?
She still ranks in the top five.
Yeah. So then this is where we are, right? Where you can do this. In the early 2000s, the idea of calling people anti-Semitic was there. I felt it. Right? It happened to me in the Pacifica Network. The alleged radicals in Pacifica were all in on this like anti-Semitic weaponization. But now it's gone to levels where people are getting kicked out of school. They're having degrees revoked. They're getting arrested. They're getting fired from their jobs, right? Same thing happened after Charlie Kirk, right? After Charlie Kirk, people got fired for saying, I don't care if Charlie Kirk was shot or Charlie Kirk was a bad guy. So 9/11, and I try not to be hyperbolic, but this really has made everything like this possible. Or at least it's greased the skids tremendously, right? Maybe this stuff was going on, obviously didn't start with 9/11. But that day, it was very clear, oh, this is gonna accelerate this, right? It's already there and we're seeing it and it's bad, but it's gonna accelerate it. And the part that I didn't understand that was missing at the time was the increase in technology. I didn't have a cell phone on 911. I didn't have a phone that had GPS on it and that could record everything I ever did, right? And with the emergence of that now, where people are getting stopped at the airport and their phones are being like hacked, right? The government's downloading their entire phone, right? Google and Meta and all these companies are willingly working with the government. They're acclimating themselves. They're accommodating everything Trump wants. Universities are, they're canceling courses, they're firing professors. Law firms are capitulating to him. The media, obviously, the media, and that was part of the war on terror, right? You couldn't really speak about this in any way other than to defend every aspect of it. And so journalists really showed their true colors after 911. 911 was horrific. It was. I mean, you can't look at that and not be horrified. It's terrifying, right? Taking airplanes and blowing up buildings. But they immediately eliminated any countervailing discourse on it. And we've been in that way. And this is like, I would actually connect today's demise, the destruction of public education with that as well. That created so many openings. And you didn't have to be smart or devious to figure them out. They were just gaping. They were right in front of you, right? Because of this now, we can get away with all these other things. And clearly that's what's happened. The world we live in today, especially if you're younger, is absolutely and utterly shaped by September 11th, right? The other part of that, and I want to end it on a, you try to end on an upbeat note though, is that it actually has awakened a lot of people. I know when that began, we were doing a lot of really cool and I think effective organizing on anti-globalization stuff. And in retrospect, and this happened in Vietnam too, where a lot, and when the Vietnam War began, you had a lot of people who were doing stuff. They were working on women's rights, they were working on civil rights, they were working on the environment. And then when the Vietnam War comes, a lot of that stuff stopped and everybody started working on Vietnam. That happened to us, I think on September 11th. And in retrospect, it's really unfortunate. And I'm not sure we could have continued doing what we were doing, but it really, but what we've seen, I think since then, if anything good has come out of all this, it's that I believe there is now a consensus that this stuff is bad, right? That, and we see numbers that are absolutely stunning to me, somebody at my age, to see the number of Americans who've turned against this type of foreign policy.
But one thing that we've seen in U.S. history is that the ruling class or the state, whatever you want to, however you want to talk about it, did a good bit of media and propaganda to sell a war. I particularly think about George H.W. Bush doing a lot to sell the war, where we're going to go liberate the Kuwaitis from Saddam Hussein, but
Mission
also
accomplished.
mission, yeah. But then also George W. Bush does that with Iraq. And he's also riding the crest of 9/11 popularity for himself. And but he's able to convince a majority of Americans it's a good idea to invade Iraq, that they had something to do with September 11th. Now, here we are like 25 years later, Trump doesn't even bother doing that, right? And as soon as he attacks Iran, first day they bomb a girls' school and kill 170 people, most of them young girls. And they don't even care about making a case for it to the American people. That's what it is that we actually have seen governments make a case for their wars to the American people so they can do it. Like the mission accomplished, but also Colin Powell going to the UN and basically selling the idea that they actually had weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, right? And so Trump doesn't do anything like that at this point. And I think part of it is he just doesn't care, like we're talking about. But I think also part of it is that they actually, this anti-war consensus, this anti-intervention consensus, and covering everything from Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, now Iran, is they've seen just such a, there's such, outside of the official institutions, there is just such a sense of this is wrong. We shouldn't be doing this. Trump, Obama kind of got into office on this. Trump gets into office on this. And then they don't even bother anymore. If they could, they would just do it without actually telling the world about it and just do it, bomb in secret.
Yeah, it won't work anymore because people have turned so vehemently against it. When in 2003, before the war,
I
the
credit
majority of
us, but not just me and you, but the movement for
no,
doing a
yeah,
lot to turn the pop global opinion against that.
yeah, no, it's a in 2003 before the hostilities actually began in March, a big majority, not a big majority, I don't remember what the numbers were, but a fairly sizable positive number of Americans supported it. Saddam Hussein is bad. We've got to go in and get rid of him, right? And that flipped fairly quickly. You
It's
know,
true.
by 2005, 2006, you started to see Americans really sour on that war. And that really hadn't happened before. And then it really snowballed from that point on to the point where that becomes really important in Trump's first victory in 2016. And even in 2024, he said, no more. He said the same thing, no more forever wars. And I was like, how could you believe him? It's like, because the other side was saying, yes, more forever wars. Biden and Harris were promising more. The thing that always astounds me, growing up when I did, I was born in 1960. Israel was as important as anything in the American political scene, right? 80% of Americans supported Israel easily, right? And Israel was always more closely associated with the Democratic Party than the Republicans, and still is very much like a Democratic leadership project, right? To look at those numbers today, where over 50% of Americans generally now don't support Israel, and over 80% of Democrats don't, is stunning. It's unbelievable. And it also says a lot that the Democratic leadership, who's been warning us about Trump being a fascist who's going to take over America and he's a dictator for all these years, is unwilling to take him on because supporting Israel is more important to them than defeating Trump. So
Right.
they're attacking their own most enthused and most energetic voters who look at them and say, you're screwing up, right? And they're losing elections because of this, and they still double down, right? They try to foist like Hayley Stevens and candidates like that upon you. And it works in some cases, Wesley Bell and Moskowitz and all. They're doubling down. Akeem Jeffries is doubling down. I mean, one of the most repugnant things in my entire life that I will ever see is Akeem Jeffries saying, Israel today, today, Israel tomorrow, Israel forever. I find that more repulsive, actually, than George Wallace saying it about segregation. Wallace is the governor of Alabama. He's got to say that, right? Jeffries is saying that as a way to say fuck you to his own people.
Let's just bring current events into it. Abdul El-Sayed just won the Michigan primary, you know, a hard-fought battle. Angie Nixon just won the Florida Senate primary and surprised everyone, a hard-fought battle, beat a Zionist establishment candidate, Eugene Vindman. And after that Florida primary, where some of the establishment candidates won, some of the Zionist candidates won, including Moskowitz, who's calls himself a DeSantis Democrat.
And Deborah Wasserman Schultz.
And Debbie Wasserman Schultz, he puts Wasserman Schultz, Wesley Bell, and Jared
Schultz.
Moskowitz as chairman on the subcommittee around Middle East affairs. That was the biggest fuck you to this insurgent movement that's winning all of these primaries, and a lot of which are centering Israel as the, especially in Michigan, are centering Israel as the issue.
And the United States and the thinking classes, the intellectuals and the politicians and the media, since 9/11, have spent time like obsessively focused on the Muslim world or the Arab world, however they want to define it, class of civilizations, all that stuff. The big piece of all this is Israel. You cannot talk about the Middle East without talking about Israel. It's Israel and oil secondarily, but I think Israel's in the last 25 years just as important as oil, right? And that's left out the United States' support of Israel, which has been huge. But keep in mind, if they're like, the only presidents who ever actually spoke up, stood up to Israel, were Reagan and the two Bushes a little bit. And so now Israel, I don't believe Israel calls the tune. And I don't believe Trump is doing what Netanyahu tells him. Although anymore, who the hell knows? Because it doesn't make sense, right? But American support of Israel has become, I think, one of the defining characteristics in global politics. And that's really, in many ways, has harmed the United States in ways that I could have never imagined. For one thing, Iran, amazingly, now has a positive reputation globally because it's taken on the United States. China has emerged, I would argue, as kind of the most influential country in the world today. And at the end of this, it may be just the most powerful country as well. China's not fighting crazy wars and spending all its money on weapons and things like that right now, the way Trump is, right? Although maybe Trump's playing, what is it, 5D chess, 6D chess now, and he's just outthinking everybody. I don't know, but it's utterly remarkable. The American military is running out of equipment. Morale is horrible. Hegseth has just destroyed the officer class. You must have massive levels of dissent internally. Every day, Hegseth fires new people. It's stunning.
That whole renaming Lake Ontario to Lake America and putting a 50% ta tax or tariff on Canadian crude, as we're seeing like a global like bottleneck of oil and gas in the Strait of Hormuz, that was like total 5D genius chess. I can't think of a smarter guy.
The world was headed towards shit anyway on September 10th, 2001. I remember it wasn't going well, and Bush had already introduced his tax cuts and everything. But the 25 years since then, and they've been deified, But even then, like, it's kind of surprising because I thought 911, it's changed everything, right? But it hasn't done what I thought it would do. I don't know how to articulate this. It's been different. We're looking at it now, and I think in a very sober way. I figured it would be this triumphant thing. Remember the Alamo, remember 911.
Remember
It really
Pearl
doesn't,
Harbor.
remember, yeah, and it really doesn't work that way. It didn't. After just a few years, it didn't take long to get over that, right? By 2004, Bush barely was reelected, and Kerry ran a shit campaign. By 2004, people had turned off, which shocked me. I thought that was going to last forever. And now I think people are looking at it more soberly. They tend to focus on, and like Trump is, Congress doesn't give a shit about the victims of 911. It took them, what, 15 years to just pass compensation for the firefighters and the people there who were damaged that day, who had health problems from there. So the whole
They don't
thing.
care about the they don't care about the vets they sent
No,
off
let's
to
give it the
fight
vets.
Afghanistan and Iraq.
Yeah. So it's just more differently. I thought it would be like deified, like you would have epic poetry, like the be like the Iliad and the Odyssey or something, right? And that didn't last long at all. It really didn't. They pissed it away so quickly. And now we're at the point where nobody trusts the government, right? Nobody expects anything out of it. 87% of Americans think all politicians are corrupt. It's really turned to shit. And I don't like doing counterfactual, what if that had never happened, right? But the way to look at that isn't what if it had never happened. It's like it did happen, and what changed as a result of that? And we're clearly in a much worse situation. And how much worse would it have been without 911? I don't know. But it's hard to imagine things being the way they are today without that catalyst on September 11th, 2001. And it really just blew everything up. And it's created a very, if any humans are alive centuries from now or 100 years from now, and they start to study this period, people like me, historians, that's a dividing line. September 11th is going to be a dividing line, much as 1865 would be, or 1776 would be, right? If these dividing lines where the world changed, the US changed, and the world changed, and clearly September,
1945, right?
clearly this is going to be one of them. Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And it's still ongoing every day in Iran. The New York Times headline today said Trump wants to, he's back to trying to foment a popular uprising in Iran. He's trying to get the people of Iran to turn against the government, right? So we're back to that. The next headline was Trump bombs wedding party in Iran, kills 5, wounds 70. We're going to get you to overthrow your government by killing wedding parties and killing girls' schools, right? So this is where we are. And it's created a situation which I could not have seen. Not like I have ESP or anything anyway. I'm not good at that, but it's unimaginable what we're seeing today from that day, that really horrific day where we were getting vegetarian barbecue in Houston, at the trailer, at the truck.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine everything that's happened in the last 25 years since then.
Yeah, it's the fear and terror of that day has turned into just desperation and pessimism. It's wild, man. No, what do you say? You don't say happy 911 on this 25th anniversary. Let's hope people think about what it meant and continue to realize that these people aren't going to save you. There's no way out of it other than to dig yourself out of this hole and to get out. People are doing it. You're seeing on these horrific circumstances, you're seeing resistance. And I think of the people in Minneapolis, the people in Chicago, people in LA, people in Columbus, Ohio. This attack, you mentioned the surveillance state, the attack on Flock all over the country. That's big. And that includes rural Republicans and inner city Democrats and all this kind of shit. So people.
The Palantir campaign is really there too, right?
Yeah.
Shout out
And
to
I
all
mean,
those
people
campaigners.
hate Elon Musk, right? And if there were, I do believe optimistically, if there were a political force actually resisting this, it would have real momentum right now. And that in bits and pieces in Mamdani or El Said or Angie Nixon or Peggy Flanagan. And these are by no means radical people, but they're simply saying what's on their mind, and they're actually fighting. And that alone has become a problem for both parties.
I think maybe this is my last thought here, is that what people don't realize is that they think the Democrats are an opposition party, but instead we're in fighting Flock and fighting data centers and fighting ICE and fighting forever wars and wars in the Middle East, is it's a bipartisan effort that we're fighting. It's the ruling
Yeah.
class, right? It's
Oh,
the
definitely.
billionaires backing a bunch of politicians to keep things going for them and take apart progress that we made over 70 years ago.
Yeah, look at all Biden's decisions on funding the military, on supporting Ukraine, on supporting Israel, on supporting cops, on supporting ICE. The numbers aren't as big, and the repression in the streets wasn't as intense, but it greased the skids. That's the kind of phrase I keep using. These people, they create the circumstances under which the next group can make things worse.
Yeah, exactly.
And if nothing else, and I'm not a big advocate of electoral system, but at least people like Mamdani and El-Sayed and Angie Nixon and others are saying, let's stop now. And stopping when you're heading off a cliff isn't a bad idea.
Yeah. Folks, we've been doing a sort of post game of 9/11. We've been doing a little bit of a reflection on 9/11 and the world since September 11th, 2001. If you like what you're hearing, please check us out on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, and Blue Sky. If you're watching this on YouTube, hit that subscribe button. If you're listening to this on an audio platform, give us a rate and review. And if you really like us, go to greenandredpodcast.org and hit that support button or become a patron at patreon.com/greenredpodcast. And until we speak again, everybody make trouble and misbehave.